Hi, I'm Jim Grierson.
And I am Will Leach. This is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 55 here at the New Republic. Grierson, how's it going, man? How you feeling? After the Trump show last week, do you feel better about America? Are you ready to dive back into the world of movies and the world of distraction, the world of escapism from the dark world that we live in?
I'm just excited we have new movies to actually talk about this week. Because everything else is not worth talking about.
No, it's not. But we actually have three new, fresh, piping hot movies this week. It's as if January is over, and now, though it's worth noting, Grierson, that already, it's maybe a bad sign, generally speaking, but the good news is, hey, three new releases in February, big studio releases that we can all talk about. Three movies of certain levels of interest, that's great. The bad news, all three are sequels or spinoffs, so I suppose that should be understood. So, because we have these three movies this week, we have no reboot. I'm sorry, we have no reboot this week. We'll be back with reboots next week. Trust me, we're about to plow through a bunch of reboots, so please do not be discouraged if your movie has not been mentioned as a reboot. We will be getting to it eventually. This is the time I should remind you to please subscribe to us on iTunes, find us on SoundCloud, and also at newrepublic.com. Please rate and review us on iTunes, and when you give us a review, this is a movie you'd like us to write it, to talk about it on this podcast, and we will discuss it. Also, make sure to email us, GriersonLeach@NewRepublic.com. We got a lot of good responses after our Trump show last week. And while most people generally appreciate the show and like the show, they also are like, great, please don't do a Trump show every week. We do want our escapism, and you will be getting it, because as far as I can think of, there's no real major reason that any of the three big releases this week should refer to the current American situation. So, we have three new movies, no reboots, but three new movies. So, Grierson, let's just dig right into it. How's that sound to you?
That sounds fabulous.
Oh, right. That was flamboyant. I enjoyed that. All right. Our first new release movie this week that we're going to discuss is the Lego Batman movie. Yeah.
You know what it is. Must be great to be Batman.
Batman, we love you.
Thank you. I'm blushing super hard under the mask.
Batman.
Pray God.
Thanks, Batman.
Yeah. I can only imagine he's going home right now to party the night away, surrounded by friends and lady activewear models.
Hey, computer. I'm home. I'm home. I'm home.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do.
Master Bruce, your greatest fear is...
snakes?
No.
Clowns?
No. It's being a part of a family again.
No, now it's snake clowns, because you put that idea in my head.
The Lego Batman movie is the spinoff from 2014's The Lego Movie. For people who remember that movie, one of its fun supporting characters was Batman. And once again, he's voiced by Will Arnett. What's important to keep in mind with the Lego Batman movie is it's essentially a parody spoof send-up of Batman movies. Will Arnett voices Batman, and he's essentially a joke version of the why-so-serious Batman that we've come to know and perhaps stopped loving from The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises and Batman vs. Superman. In this world, he is a loner. He's very proud of himself for the fact that he doesn't need anybody. He's very proud of himself because he's the greatest superhero of all time and everybody loves him. He is on the trail of the Joker, voiced by Zach Galifianakis. And as part of this movie's kind of overall theme, the Joker just really, really, really wants Batman to acknowledge that he is his favorite arch nemesis, which Batman won't do, which puts the plot into motion. If you've seen Batman movies, if you've seen comic book movies, you will appreciate the Lego Batman movie, because essentially it just takes all those little tropes and makes fun of them over about an hour and 44 minutes. Rosario Dawson plays Barbara Gordon, the new police commissioner. Michael Cera plays who is going to become Robin. And I have to say that I was a big fan of the Lego movie. I thought it was one of the best films of 2014, partly because of the surprise of it, the fact that they actually figured out how to make a movie about the Lego universe without it just being an ad for Legos. I think the Lego Batman movie is pretty fun. I think it's pretty funny. I think it's pretty clever. But I also have to say this movie is sort of like Pop Rocks in that the first half an hour or so of it is, I think, incredibly clever and really well done and really, really smart and funny. And then it kind of runs out of gas as it goes along. I think it's still funny enough. Ray Fiennes plays Alfred in this. It's got enough, like, funny nods to the Batman universe and sort of, like, mocking certain conventions of these types of movies. But it is ultimately, I think, a one-joke film. They expand that joke. They stretch that joke. They do a lot of fun things with that joke. But it is just one joke. And I did find myself getting kind of tired of the movie by the end. I think it's fun enough, but it's not nearly as inspired or as emotional as the...
Yeah, I kind of like Batman, this Batman. I loved the first Batman in, well, and as Batman in the first Lego movie, if just because he did feel so surprising and it felt like this wonderful send-up of Batman, and then he left the movie. And then he came back and reminded us how much we liked him in the beginning of the movie. And, oh, that's a great little fun play on Batman. Here, it's a lot of that Batman. And to the point where it's also worth keeping in mind that I kind of like the darkness of Batman, if that makes sense. There are times, like, the fun of the Batman, the first Lego movie, is it's like, yeah, it's playing with a Batman character, the dead parents, no happiness, and, like, kind of great joke. It's a really great, like the song, and it's so over the top, and it's awesome. But here it feels like it edges up to a... almost taking the character too irreverently, if that makes sense. I've read some Abraham Riesman, who writes for Vulture, wrote a piece. He really knows comic books very well. He wrote saying that, yes, this is the Batman movie we've been waiting for. Batman's gotten too dark. These have gotten too self-serious. And on one hand, listen, I don't want to sit through Batman vs. Superman any more than anybody else does. But I would definitely sit through The Dark Knight again, and I would definitely sit through Batman Begins again. There is a weight to this character that at times this feel, you said Pop Rocks. It does feel a little bit too Pop Rocks sometimes. It feels a little, there are times I'm like, all right, you might be having a little bit too much fun with Batman right now. They just kind of give him a traditional story arc of he has this problem. He won't let himself love, and then he starts to let himself love, and then something bad happens, and he learns, oh, nope, I have to let people in. So basically, right out of Robert McKee's story, basically every single story arc, and I find it almost diminishing of Batman in a way. I think this movie is very fun, but I do think that this is too much of that silliness of Batman to, I think, go through a whole film. By the end, I wanted, like, a little bit of actual Batman. Like a Batman-type character, as opposed to this... After a while, it starts feeling like Muppet Babies Batman. I know it's a kid movie, and I know I don't need this to have the true darkness of a Christopher Nolan movie. But I do feel like in a little bit, it's having a little bit too much fun and not weighted any sort of real thing that I found ultimately a little bit distracting.
Yeah, I mean, what I think makes the Lego movie great is I think it actually appeals to both kids and adults. This movie, I feel like, ultimately appeals more to kids. Obviously, there are the references to the older Batman movies that adults will like. There's also a Jim Cotter reference in this movie, by the way. But it just feels, I mean, you mentioned that it's kind of a traditional plot. This movie has 5 credited screenwriters. I'd be curious who else actually worked on this movie. It feels like joke, 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 joke. And they're all hanging on a pretty thin narrative through line. And that the story is just an excuse for joke, 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 joke. And what's funny is that the Lego movie was not dissimilar. I mean, that movie is kind of wall-to-wall gags. But I think what this movie shows is that what Phil Lord and Chris Miller did so well in that movie is, and I think they do this really well in their movies in general, is I think that they actually go beyond the idea of what's the thing we're spoofing and also actually kind of making that movie. I don't think that Chris McKay, who is an animation director who's now the director on this movie, he and the 5 screenwriters, including Seth Graham Smith, I don't feel like I don't walk away from the Lego Batman movie feeling like this movie gets to the core of what's great about Batman. I think they know what's funny about Batman, and I think that they have a real kind of sense of play, but it doesn't have that great, deep love of pop the way the Lego movie does. And so, I like the, you know, you said Muppet Babies. I thought of Puss in Boots. Like, Puss in Boots is a totally fine character in the Shrek movies. I'm not sure we needed a whole movie of him. And likewise, I want to be clear. I laughed a lot in this movie, but after a while, I just sort of laughed sporadically at stuff that was happening. I didn't feel like I actually got a great Batman movie. I mean, the last thing I just want to say is that I think it's very telling that the people who seem to like this movie the most tend to say things like, oh, finally, a good Batman movie.
Right.
And my feeling is, with all due respect to those people, there have actually been several really good Batman movies, and if this movie is the
one... And a couple truly great ones.
Yes, and so it's like, if this is the one that really appeals to you, I would respectfully suggest, I don't think this movie is exactly doing what it could do at its height. Yes, it makes fun of Batman very Superman. That's funny. It's enjoyable. But this movie kind of has the same thing I think that Deadpool has, which is it's fun, but it's almost an anti-movie as opposed to giving us another version of an actual movie.
Yeah, you know, think about I feel like a lot of the positive response to this movie, and again, for the record, I do think this movie is funny. I do ultimately give it a positive review. But I think one of the reasons that people are really getting into this movie is timing. Because right now, Zack Snyder's movies are so terrible, and their Batman is so dark, and it's murder Batman. And we've discussed in many, many occasions how bad Batman and Superman is. And right now is a time where, like, the whole DC universe is terrible and dark and stupid, and they're so desperate for, like, a light thing on this. But imagine how stupid this movie would look. People would think this movie was, or how annoyingly derivative it was if it came out a year after The Dark Knight.
Right.
Like, imagine what we'd be talking about. We'd be like, oh, well, this movie's just like, I don't know. Why is the Bane and these dumb and Condiment Man and all of these people? That's not what Batman is. That was back at the time where we had just seen the two greatest Batman movies, maybe the two greatest comic book movies that have ever been made. And we were taking the character seriously. We're now this, as you, I think you aptly call it, this anti-movie almost feels like an antidote to another movie, which I think I'm always wary of overpraising a movie just because it seems to be a well-timed antidote to a movie that nobody likes in a lot of ways. And I think that feels like this. This feels like people that really want a light, silly superhero movie and don't really care about Batman at all.
Yeah, I mean, Ben Affleck waffling about whether or not he's going to direct the next Batman movie was like the greatest promotional push Lego Batman movie could have asked for, because it's in the air right now. Like, oh, but is Batman even like good anymore? Like, where is that franchise going? I mean, the Lego Batman movie feels like a very astute commercial course correction for Warner Brothers. And when you're talking in that language, it's, you know, incredibly inspiring in terms of like film and art, honestly. The first Lego movie, I think, got around the problem of how do you just like not just like sell Legos to kids, because it was really clever and really smart. I will confess that this movie also has the problem of, what are other Warner Brothers properties, villains that we can use? Oh, the guy from Harry Potter, and we can use King Kong, and we can use Godzilla. I think, the Lord of the Rings. It's like you get a little bit of that as well. This movie is still fun, but it's not unlike the Batman franchise or like the DC world in general, where you can kind of see the diminishing returns of the intellectual property that's being serviced in this product.
Yeah, and that's the last thing on this before we get to the grades. I actually feel it's like that sense of discovery that you get from the first Lego movie and the excitement. And then, not to spoil the first Lego movie, when you peel back and realize this is in fact part of a larger universe, and which I think almost gives what's going on an extra emotional heft. Here, this is just we just make Lego movies out of our major properties. And I think I saw the preview for the next one, which is some ninja thing that I don't know anything about. And it feels like it's amazing what felt so new and surprising and exciting about the first Lego movie already in the second movie feels like formula. Like it already feels like, oh, so they're going to do this. Like when they need to jazz up the Indiana Jones property, they'll do the Lego Indiana Jones movie and they'll be able to do that. And then they'll do, if they ever have to do a Lego Star Wars, they'll do that. It does kind of feel already, and I know they have, I know there's like made for DVD or made for cable Lego movies that don't have the production values of these and don't have the, but like I know there is a franchise of those, and you can see why that might be, because it already it feels like, oh, so you can just plug all the things that are very self-serious about this beloved franchise, scramble them up, make them funny and comedy and make them a Lego, and boom, you've got a movie. And to me, which is fine, I think it works well here. I bet by the third or fourth Lego big movie, I'm going to be kind of sick of them.
Yeah, this is sort of like the DVDs to Blu-rays of like repackaging stuff that you already have and making you feel like you need it again. We've bashed a movie that we both like, but I think that but I have to say, you can feel like the dark clouds on the horizon of what the potential of this is. Like, oh no, I see where this is going. I actually do think Zach Galifianakis is actually a very funny Joker, by the way, because I think he's so incredibly needy as the villain. It's fun, but part of the movie's problem is I don't think the story is so great. So he's kind of left by the wayside, kind of like everybody else is in the movie. So anyway, so what is your grade, Will?
I give it a B-.
Yeah, I gave it a very low B. The first half an hour, I have to say, is really tremendous. It's really funny. It actually kind of made me wish this was a short film, honestly. So I gave it a B.
All right, so that is the Lego Batman movie. Two adults hammering your Lego Batman movie. So that we do like it, for what it's worth. It's weird. I don't like this Lego Batman movie enough. Roar. Yes. Okay, so.
But what does it mean for the future of cinema?
Yes. Exactly. Yes. Listen, people don't listen to the Grierson Leach podcast for us to breeze past movies, Grierson. We take them, and we're going to have to keep going with this because we got two more of these. All right, so that is Lego Batman movie. Our next movie is John Wick, Chapter 2.
Accounts payable, how may I help you?
I'd like to open an account.
Name on the account?
John Wick.
The contract has gone international.
You have no idea what's coming.
Somebody please get this man a gun.
John Wick Chapter 2, The Ocho, Part Dia, The Dis. Unofficial titles that I've just added on to the end. John Wick Chapter 2 is directed by...
We're not going to make that a thing, right? We're not going to... No. Go ahead. No.
50 Shades Part Dia. John Wick Chapter 2. directed by Chad Stahelski. Written by Derek Kolstad, who, of course, directed characters from the first movie, which we have already reviewed in one of our first reboot sections on this podcast. So we advise everyone, remind you all once again, to go to GriersonLeach.com, and under podcast, you can see every movie that we have reviewed on this podcast and click and go straight to the SoundCloud. Handy little feature that I spent a whole afternoon putting together. So I encourage everyone to do that. You can listen to our review of the first John Wick movie. John Wick Chapter 2, Keanu Reeves is back as the eponymous John Wick. This takes place fairly recently, fairly soon after the first movie. Once again, he is trying to retire again. Once again, he is unable to retire. It turns out the Italian crime lord named Santino D'Antonio, which is I think that's just Italian guy. Italian crime lord.
Hey, I'm Italian. I like to kill the people with the pasta.
His name is Santonio D'Antonio. So anyway, he comes in and he decides that he has a marker, which again, in the convoluted mythology of the, which gets much more convoluted in this movie. Of the world of professional killers. Apparently he has a marker, and if you have a marker that somehow John Wick has, before he wanted to retire, claimed that he owed, he has to go kill. It turns out that the mobster wants him to kill his sister, who has taken his place at some sort of big mobster table. So John Wick does not want to do it, but has no choice, because he goes to Ian McShane, and Ian McShane is the lord of all the serial killers, of all the main assassins, and he's like, nope, you got to mark, you got to do it. So he ends up doing it. That ends up backfiring on him, because now he puts the Italian mobster says, nope, you cannot kill my sister and get away with it, even though I hired you to do it. And now everybody wants to kill John Wick, which brings back to what the whole point of the John Wick franchise is, which is, how many people can John Wick kill? That is basically one of the things that was really fun about the first movie, as we discussed in this podcast, was there the efficiency of John Wick. The guy is so good that he just knows the quickest ways to kill people. Kick them in the leg, shoot them in the chest, then shoot them in the head, and then move on to the next one. This allows for all sorts of mass killings. As with the first movie, I find the, I'm John Wick, I just want to retire, why won't let me retire? And people going to him be like, don't you know who you are? You are a killer. He's like, no, I want to retire. Is the least interesting part of this movie. It was the least interesting part of the first movie. Is the least interesting part of this movie. The most interesting part of the first movie and to this movie is John Wick can kill a whole bunch of motherfuckers. And he kills a lot of motherfuckers in this movie. He kills many, many motherfuckers in this movie. I think that inevitably, because this is a sequel, I think it's a little bit less exciting to see a lot of the fun things in this. The hotel, now we learn there's another, Continental is what the hotels are called. There's another one in Italy where there's a sommelier who, of course, knows all the great guns. And there are tailors that are actually making suits full of the tactical suits full that are bulletproof. The amount of, in the world of the John Wick movies, if you are on a bus and there are not at least three professional killers on that bus with you at that time, there are. Just trust me. There are. Everyone in this world is a secret professional assassin. You never know when you're going to come across somebody. It's all this secret society that lives among us, which, again, is kind of fun. And this movie definitely dials up that mythology a little bit and definitely ramps that up to the point where it almost lives within. A large part of the movie is preparation for these big violent scenes rather than the actual big violent scenes. I will confess, even though I've seen this John Wick before, there's not a lot of new added to it, I still think it's pretty fun. I still think it's pretty, I still can watch John Wick kill a lot of people. I still, the action sequences, they don't feel, there's some really good ones. They don't feel extra inspired. The movie has a little bit of that, but not too much of, a little bit of a, well, we have to make it a little bigger this time. And it does do that, which is a constant sequel problem, but it's not a huge problem because it doesn't go too big with it. It knows what side its bread's buttered on, and it's John Wick killing a lot of people. So there's nothing, no new reinventions of the wheel here. And there's going to be a little bit of diminishing returns, but ultimately I still got a kick out of it.
Yeah, I liked it enough. The theme of the week for everybody is Tim liked the new one just a little bit less than the last one. I mean, this movie, what was great about the first one, among other things, was, oh my God, this guy is going to shoot so many people in the head. Like, that was what was legitimately, I remember laughing at that because it was a genuine shock of how often he would do that, and then the shock of recognition of, oh, that would make sense if you were an assassin. That's how you would do it. This movie, it's harder to be surprised, shocked, delighted by that, and I think along the same lines, the whole conceit of what was fun about the first John Wick movie, which is, wait, Keanu Reeves is an assassin? Like, that alone was fun because he kind of played it a little bit tongue-in-cheek, and I think that worked really nicely. I think that this, the John Wick Chapter 2 does have that problem of, whoa, 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 now we're going to take this seriously. And, you know, I wrote the review for us for the New Republic, and one of the things I mentioned at the top of it is that the first movie is like 140 minutes. This movie is just over 2 hours. And that's part of the problem, I think, with this movie, is it's a little more inflated. It takes itself a little more seriously. It kind of invests more in this idea of, but what is the universe of John Wick, and how does this whole world work? If that's the game, I much prefer The Raid 2 in terms of how you really just take a concept and explode it in a sequel. This one's fun, but it's a little less fun just because I think it's too big in certain ways. I'm not as interested in the world building that this movie does. And also, as weird as it is to say, this movie is not as emotional as the first one because it doesn't do as much with the device of the dead wife and the dead dog, which I actually think gave that movie a little bit of an extra kick. I think the action sequences are more beautifully composed. There's like a Hall of Mirrors sequence. It's really, really awesome. And there's like one in like a subway station that's also really awesome. But there is a bit of a film, like a familiarity in this movie, which I think just makes it not as great as the first one.
There's some fun stuff, though. You mentioned that subway sequence. My favorite part of that subway sequence, Common plays another assassin, Cassian, who is an old colleague of John Wick's, and I think they respect each other while also both being really skilled. And there's this very funny moment when you realize, because one of the great jokes of this, of course, is that these assassins must exist among us all the time and never be detected, which leads to this very amusing moment where each of them are on opposite lines of a New York City subway crossing, and they are firing silencer guns at each other while trying to walk as if no one is noticing them. It's actually a very funny deadpan scene. I think that is like closer to what I think these movies do really well. I think another one issue with this movie, which is the same issue I had with the first movie, one of the problems with John Wick being completely indestructible and just being able to kill everyone in his path, it's hard to find a worthwhile villain. It was a problem in the first movie. It's also a problem in this one. Inevitably, just no one is going to be as formidable as John Wick. And I don't want to give anything away of how this movie ends. I think that this movie ends in a way, I would note, that nods to that possibility, to where maybe one or two of the characters we've grown over these movies to respect a little bit will ultimately have to battle John Wick a little bit. But I do think that hurts in that one of the great things that's really fun about John Wick is that he can kill everyone and kill so many people. The bad news is there's no one that you can take seriously as someone that can kill John Wick, because John Wick can destroy everybody. And I think that hurts the movie a little bit. I just don't think it hurts it that much. Lawrence Fishburne's very kind of dull. Like, he doesn't really have a lot to do in this movie. He just kind of shows up as like, oh, they were in the Matrix together. Yep, there they are. And that's really just kind of, you're supposed to have that thrill of recognition, but he doesn't really have much of a character to play. I still found this movie really fun, though. I when we talk about the diminishing returns of the Lego Batman movies compared to the first Lego movie, I think that's here, but I would watch another one of these. I find myself not dreading the next one of these the way I kind of maybe would dread the next Lego movie.
Well, first of all, Lawrence Fishburne is a fascinating character because he likes pigeons, apparently.
On rooftops, of course. Of course, he is an African-American on the rooftop in New York City, which means, of course, he must raise pigeons.
Yeah. that whole part of this movie is so dumb. My favorite new element is actually Ruby Rose as Santino's androgynous deaf assassin henchwoman person. I actually think she's really fun, and I kind of wish that she'd had more, because she's as close as this movie gets to an interesting villain. I feel like for me, my favorite action sequence we haven't mentioned is what happens when John Wick and Common's character keep falling down flights of stairs mid-battle. That I think is actually really kind of fun. I would see another one of these. I'm legally obligated to see another one of these, so that's it works out perfectly for me. This movie does end on a note where I'm intrigued where it goes next. yeah, it's solid. I gave it a B minus. That's all I'll say. I gave it a B minus. I did kind of get tired of it after a while. I just feel like Keanu Reeves, the more you ask of him, the less you get. And this movie kind of starts to say, no, like, we're going to take this seriously, and that does not work to his strengths, I mean, as an actor.
I think that's true. And I find it's funny because his physicality, which is always one of the underrated things about him as an actor, it's why he works so well in The Matrix, it's why he works so well in some other movies. He still can work these scenes pretty well, but he's also, like, he's a couple years away to where they're going to have to, like, start cutting him like Seagal. Like, to keep doing these movies. Like, he's still got the physicality, he's still in shape, and he still looks good. But there is, and I think that's part of that's supposed to be there in the character. He's a little bit more beaten down. One of the things that's fun about John Wick is that, you know, he will kill people that are bigger than him and stronger than him and faster than him. He's just able to find ways to do it. But I do kind of like, that he feels a little bit slower in this movie, in a way, and he gets very beaten and slowed by the end of the movie, I think is in a way that works, to the point where he reaches a level of exhaustion to where he has to make a pretty big decision that might not work out well for him in the long run. I think that stuff generally kind of works. I'm curious to see, though, as much as I would be eager to see a third one of these, I'm sure we're going to get one, that I'm wondering how much more he can be at the center of all of these fight scenes without feeling like that Steven Seagal problem of, I know that you're not able to do all of these things.
Right.
And we're just going to cut it around.
And of course, that's the selling point of these movies is, look at all the long takes we do that we don't cut around. It's not the Liam Neeson and Taken problem where you have to, like, cut because he can't do all of that stuff. Yes, I would recommend that they hurry. To do this third one.
So he is slowing down, right? He is slowing down. You can see it in that one.
As we all are, tragically. All are. Yeah. So what? So would you give it?
I give it a B. I liked it more than you did. I'm into these movies. So I think it's a little bit less than the first one, but not as much less than the first one. Then our last movie was less than the first one. Speaking of movies that may or may not be less than the first, because it's sequel week here with our new releases. Our final movie of the week is 50 Shades Darker.
I want you back. I'm not very good at this. I've never wanted to try again. Have dinner with me.
Okay, fine. I will have dinner with you. Because I'm hungry. But we are only talking, and that is it.
50 Shades Darker is the second film in the 50 Shades series. I guess that's the shorthand for this series. It's those movies. It's the second of those movies from that writer who nobody likes or respects.
It's two shades, two darker.
This is going to be tough enough to get through as it is.
I'm sorry.
For people who have been dying for the director of Glengarry Glen Ross to make one of these, you're in luck. James Foley is the director of 50 Shades Darker. It once again stars Dakota Johnson and Jamie Dornan. For people who saw 50 Shades of Grey from 2015, which was a huge, and we have to emphasize this, a huge international hit, both in the U.S. and across the globe. This is the sequel. Dakota Johnson once again plays Anna, who broke up with Christian, played by Jamie Dornan in the last film, because she realized that she could never accept the relationship that he wanted to have, where he was the dominant and she was the submissive. As this movie begins, Christian basically talks his way back into her heart rather easily, I would like to point out. And so they decide that they're going to have a more traditional relationship where it's not dominant and submissive. It's not so BDSM-centric. They're going to actually try and be like a quote-unquote normal couple. Will that work out? Well, there are obstacles. For instance, Christian has a former girlfriend, played by Bella Heathcote, who is always conveniently in the background of shots, looking at them as if it's a horror movie. They also have the problem of the older woman who seduced Christian when he was a teenager and is still very much part of his life, played by Kim Basinger. More on that in a moment. I will own up to the fact that I enjoyed the first movie in this series. I didn't think it was great cinema by any stretch of the imagination, but I liked it for two reasons. The first is I actually thought it was legitimately sexy in a mainstream Hollywood kind of way where you don't often see that. I thought it did that pretty decently. And two, I thought that it very much had a sense of knowing, listen, Christian is totally boring, and we're going to let Anna, played by Dakota Johnson, just needle him for 2 hours. And I found that pretty damn enjoyable. And it actually made me kind of turn the corner on Dakota Johnson and think, oh, I think she may have something, which was validated by how good she is, I think, in A Bigger Splash, which came out last year. The problem with this movie is that while it's, I guess, still kind of sexy and Anna still is kind of making fun of Christian because he is the most boring man on the face of the earth, it's just too silly and dopey. I've read the reviews, you may have as well, listeners, from people, from film critic friends of ours, who kind of love how cheesy and silly and kind of cotton candy this movie is. I just think it's too dumb to give it the credit for being like campy and silly and trashy. To me, this movie is just kind of dumb and it's not fun enough. It's just kind of garbage. And while I still was able to kind of enjoy it on certain levels for its a kind of junk food kind of quality, a second go around with these two characters, it's really hard to sell me on that. Neither of them are very interesting. I don't find their relationship that interesting. And it's definitely not developing in a way where I'm intrigued for more of these. So I sort of sat there just sort of perplexed by the whole thing. I wasn't bored, but I can't say I was entertained by what I experienced.
Yeah. I will say that she's great again in this. She's great. I think she's fantastic. For her to not only keep a straight face in both of these movies, but to almost yank them. When we discussed the first movie, I said I was impressed how I reviewed it for us with Deadspin. And I was impressed how she and the director were somehow to shape this muddled mess of a story and characters into a movie-type substance. It almost resembled a movie-type substance. This is even farther away from a movie-type substance, but she's fun to watch. She kind of does that really nice balancing thing of playing along with, this is stupid, he's stupid, this is all kind of dumb, but not having that Kristen Stewart by the fourth Twilight movie of get me out of here, I want nothing to do with this anymore, I have better things to do. Like, she's still, Kristen Stewart had better things to do, and so does Dakota Johnson, but she's just invested enough to where you don't find yourself irritated by her or the movie. She sells it the best she can while still being able to step away from it a little bit. That's really hard to do. And I think I find myself respecting that level of skill in the movie because there's no other real skill at all going on. Certainly Foley does his best to keep things moving, keep things going along. But like, this movie is dumber than a box of rocks. He is, first off, like, Jamie Dornan is the same block of wood in this movie that he was in the first movie. There is nothing interesting about him. The idea that he's going through some sort of change or from the whatever character he was in the first movie, I'm sure read horribly in the book. It plays pretty terribly here. There's nothing interesting about him as an actor. There's nothing interesting about him as a character. And he doesn't have the skill that she does of playing a nothing character and giving it a little bit of a spark. And it's also worth noting that nothing actually really happens in this movie. There's nothing, a lot of really big occurrences. You know, they go to one party and then woman shows up in the background. They go to another party and there's Kim Basinger. And then suddenly his helicopter crashes out of nowhere with no real setup and nowhere explanation. And then he's like, oh, no, he's fine. And we all kind of move on from it. The movie feels, I cannot fathom how bad these books must be. Like, I've not read them, and I don't know if the sex scenes are written very well or not, but they just seem so terribly written and constructed. These stories go nowhere. They just meander forever, and then a lightning bolt comes because we need something to happen in the plot, and we need the movie to end, but none of it means anything. None of the characters have any sort of motivation. It's all very stupid. The sex scenes themselves, again, these are attractive people. They are even more so in the first film. They start to feel like, and here's the musical number. Like, they definitely feel that way now. It's they're starting to feel more and more like a Silk Stockings episode on Showtime or something. They start to feel that they're definitely have gone full bore into Cinemax land. Whereas in the first film, you know, she's kind of an interesting director, so she would put like kind of this feminist twist on it. Here it's just here's your sex scene, da, 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 and then they move on to the rest of the movie. It does feel like the musical numbers, which is fine. They're not terrible, but. And again, I they're attractive people. I think she's a sexy woman, and she seems to be she gets the right tone in that. But they're so dumb, and the movie's just so stupid that I find myself because of her, and because I can tell the source material is just dog shit, that I find myself giving these movies the benefit of the doubt for just making, as I said, a movie type substance.
Yeah, I saw this movie like 2 days after seeing John Wick Chapter 2, and I was like, oh, well, these are kind of the same movie, where like the sex scenes are like the action sequences, essentially, and they show up at regular intervals to keep you entertained. And you know, I refer to it as the, you know, they're very vanilla, the sex scenes. They're vanilla sexy, you know, and, you know, because you don't get much of that in mainstream movies, I still enjoy them. I think they're more interesting in terms of how they reveal character than anything the characters actually say to one another during the movie. Mm-hmm. So that kind of helps. Because this has come up, I have to ask you. So I went to an all media screening on this past Wednesday, and near the end of the movie, there's a very kind of serious scene that happens between Christian and Anna in Christian's bedroom. And in the background of the shot, there is a poster of a certain movie. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what your experience was, because nobody knew yet that this was in the movie. I sat there and went, wait, is that a Chronicles of Riddick poster? And I just kept staring at it, and I wasn't paying attention to what Christian was saying. And I started to hear people laugh around me, and I realized, wait, are they all seeing the same thing? Because usually, I have to say, I'm one of those people, I don't know if you're this way, where if there's like a bookcase in the background, I'll kind of look to see what the books are. Or if there's a poster, I'll look. So I'm kind of guilty about that in general. But I was like, oh, wait, we're all sharing this moment together, aren't we? So is that your experience? Did you also?
I'd heard about it beforehand, that the Chronicles of Riddick poster shows up. I will say, though, that I was... That, you know, earlier we see his room, because again, I was actually curious to see Christian Grey, like the Christian Grey's childhood bedroom. I found myself somewhat curious because this character makes no sense. So I thought, okay, well, maybe the bedroom will be a clue in. He also has a UFC poster yes, up in his room.
He does.
And amusingly, of course, one of the plot lines, I guess, of Christian Grey is that he lost his mother at a young age. And so he's got a picture of her. Like a glossy picture of her, not in a frame, that he has stuck at the bottom of the UFC poster that is framed. So one thing that we've learned about Christian Grey is that he, in fact, he will not frame a photo, apparently the lone photo of his dead mother, but he will frame a random UFC fight poster.
Yeah, I had so many questions about the UFC poster. Like, is that supposed to indicate that his love of people in pain or distributing pain, because he's into being a dominant? Like, what's that about?
I know there's no answers, Kirsten. I think there's no answers. I think there's just, that may have just been a producer's room that they had on set.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you saw the quote where Jamie Dornan was asked about the Chronicles of Riddick poster, and he's like, "Yeah, you know, it just, it was a Universal movie, so it just sort of like it made sense because 50 Shades Darker comes out through Universal." I'm like,
Okay. Boy, that's motivation. I will tell you, that is exactly what I would think Jamie Dornan would say when asked about his character's motivation. Oh, well, it's corporate synergy, obviously.
Right. Yes.
Okay. You wanted to say something about Kim Basinger. You mentioned Kim Basinger earlier.
Yeah. What's up with that character? I love so much that, you know, she plays, and I haven't read the books, so I'm sounding like I know what I'm talking about, like most weeks on the podcast. And as I said before, she plays this woman that seduced him when he was a teenager and was a very kind of sexually formative experience for him. Anna is very suspicious of this person, especially because her name is Elena. She really believes that she's like the love of his life. The movie in the last 20 minutes or so goes into this incredibly wonderful, like, telenovela kind of like melodrama thing. And I don't want to be this way, but it's like Kim Basinger's performance is so kind of amazingly campy and wonderful. I thought, oh, that's the movie. Like, that's the tone. I mean, as our listeners may have heard, you know, people get glasses of alcohol thrown in other people's faces. People get slapped. There's like cat fights and people being bitchy and like that. It's so like wonderfully delicious. And you think, oh, like that's the spirit that this movie should sort of be. Like, this is the worst of the three movies that we've talked about. There is a lot of juice and like pulpy silliness in this movie that I was able to kind of go along with. Kim Basinger has a lot to do with it. Marcia Gay Harden, who plays his mother, she helps a little bit as well. But yeah.
There's one more coming in a year. They're already filmed. I think it's almost done filming. 50 Shades Freer comes out literally in a year.
Yes,
and then we're done.
You don't always stay through the credits. Did you stay for the little like?
No, I didn't. What happened?
There's a preview of the next movie. This is how I would describe the little snippet of 50 Shades Freer you get at the end of this movie. It's like an E.L. James novel got like crossed with a Dan Brown novel, because it's mostly like people in, I think, Italy, like walking around through museums as suspicious thriller-like elements are happening. I'm not sure if they like start solving a crime or there's like clues at the Vatican or something, but that is coming our way next Valentine's Day.
All right. Well, that'll be exciting for me and you. So when next year, when we're discussing on this date in a year, the Lego Ninja Movie, John Wick Chapter 3, and 50 Shades Freer, those will be the three movies we discuss in a year from now. We'll be like, wow, finally some quote-unquote new movies. And this is what we'll do for every year, the rest of our life, until we die. I'm excited with that. I'm actually okay with that.
Yeah. All right. So what did you give
50 Shades? I give it a gentleman's C.
as long as a gentleman C. Yeah. I gave it a C+. That's what
I gave it. Enough. Yeah. That's, but you like the first one more. You actually, and listen, I find myself the defender of these movies. This one is very hard to defend, much harder to defend than the first one. And I have a feeling the third one will just make me want to handcuff my hands around my head and. Let's just move on. Okay, so that is 50 Shades Darker. Grierson, we nailed all three movies. That was very good. That was. I'm excited to have new movies to talk about too. There are actually 2017 movies out in theaters. Three big releases, even if they're all sequels.
Yeah, I'm excited that we had some new movies. Now I'd like some really good movies. That would also be. Is that too much to ask? Apparently, that might be.
That very well might be. So next week we have one new movie to talk about. We'll be talking about The Great Wall, which is Matt Damon and the Great Wall of China and dragons, I believe. There seems to be something, some sort of dragon.
Right. Yes, it's Matt Damon and co-star The Great Wall. That's
The
yes.
Great Wall. And I just worry every single time I watch a preview trailer for that movie, I'm like, careful with that bow and arrow. You're going to get your hair caught in there, Matt Damon. Be careful, Matt Damon. Your hair will get caught in your bow and arrow. Also next week, it'll be our last show before the Oscars. So we're going to do a big Oscar preview. We'll look at the major categories. We'll talk about what we might expect from Jimmy Kimmel, the host. We've done a lot of writing about the hosts, what we kind of want out of a host, what we expect out of a host, what hosts we've liked, what hosts we haven't. We'll do a little Oscar preview for you because it'll be our last show. The show will go up the Tuesday before the Oscars are on that Sunday. And we have one reboot movie. Our reboot movie is Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Came out in 1984, of course, directed by Steven Spielberg, the second of the Indiana Jones movies, the first movie to get a PG-13 because of Molaram Sudaram, and the beating heart that he pulls out of a man's chest. When's the last time you saw that movie, Kirsten?
Oh, God, 20 years, maybe? It's been a while.
So I think that was what caused Roger Ebert to coin the phrase the forearm bruise movie, because I think that in his review, he famously loved The Temple of Doom. Lots of other people did not like it as much, but I'm very excited to see it. So next week is the Oscar preview. We'll be discussing The Great Wall, and our reboot will be Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Grierson. Good show. Now I'm telling you, next year we're going to have to do a sequel to this exact show, and it's going to be everything that we did on this show, but a little bit louder and a little bit bigger and a little bit less satisfying.
Yeah, I'm already sort of, but we'll expand the universe of the Grierson and Leach podcast, so that will give fans something else to kind of savor.
It will end with you slapping and throwing the drink in the face of Kim Basinger.
Yes, there'll be a cliffhanger at the end of the episode. So even though you don't want to keep listening, you have to find out what happens next.
Yeah, when you get through the credits of this episode, it'll be us in Italy running through museums.
Hey, Will, watch out for the meat cleaver.
Prego. Bellissimo. Okay, that's enough. All right, Kirsten, before we do something we ultimately regret, have a great week. We'll be back next week with our Oscar preview, The Great Wall, and our reboot, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. See you, Kirsten.
Bye.
Bye.